If you want to encourage colleagues to collaborate on team projects and form strong relationships, it makes perfect sense to have them share a workspace. A room full of desks in close proximity, it signals an employer's wish to break down silos between coworkers or departments, get everybody on the same page. There's just one problem. Most people who work in open office spaces really hate them. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Workers dislike these desk and cubicle warehouses for a lot of reasons. Lack of privacy, constant hum of noise, way too much exposure to the smell of those tuna sandwiches your office mate insists on eating at their desk. In fact, research shows that open office plans often interfere with teamwork in surprising ways. Is it any wonder so many people are begging to keep working from home? George Musser is a contributing editor at Scientific American, where you can read his article, Fixing the Hated Open Office Design. George, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me and letting me rant about my least favorite type of office.
So do you have offices like this at Scientific American, or is that where you work out of?
I actually work out of home for the past few years, but yes, Scientific American does indeed have a big open plan bullpen kind of arrangement.
Yeah, we have them here as well in a lot of departments. We should maybe talk about what the term open office means. Does this refer only to spaces where all the desks are entirely out in the open, or do cubicle farms in their many iterations count as well?
Yeah, this is a really good question, and it speaks to kind of evolving nature of the usage of the term. There's no fixed meaning open office or open plan office. Cubicles, on one definition, would be open in the sense that there's no hard partitions. You can still hear what's going on in the next cubicle. But in another definition, they would actually be considered private or closed. In fact, cubicles as kind of a paradigm for office design came in the 80s in response to earlier complaints about a even more open plan office. So cubicles were at the time meant to sort of pull back a little bit from a true open plan office and at least give some modicum of privacy to people.
This is ironically a story that speaks to the importance of science for testing whether ideas that intuitively make sense actually work as intended. Tell us about what the first designers of open offices thought they would do for companies and employees.
So yeah, the idea of an open office goes really far back. I mean, early 20th century, Frank Lloyd Wright had some designs that actually are still in place. But usually the kind of big bang of the open office is ascribed to the late 60s. A group known as the Korkborner is a German design consortium that promoted this idea. A lot of American furniture manufacturers then took it up as well. And the idea was to break down the silos, like you see on Mad Men or some of these period TV shows, people really off on their own, not really communicating with one another, part of a big corporate hierarchy that made fine distinctions of status. And the open office was meant to break all that down and have a more organic arrangement of an office environment. So the intention was understandable, very 60s kind of mentality of an organic quality to one's workspace. And like a lot of things in life, it seemed like a good idea at the time. And in fact, even today, some people actually actively do like an open office of that sort. At the time, in the late 60s, early 70s, the downsides, as you mentioned, of noise, visual distraction, all sorts of privacy issues were obvious really from the get-go. But they were thought to be the acceptable trade-off for the facility of communication among people. And I think what began to happen is that the negative side of the trade-off became more apparent to people, and the positive side kind of didn't really succeed.
What made the chemical company DuPont decide to try this back in the late 60s?
I don't know specifically their motivations. They were doing a series of office renovations, and one floor, an internal corporate experiment perhaps, they decided to turn into an open plan office on this Korkborner philosophy. Korkborner itself, it was trying to move into the U.S., so there was a good commission for them as well. And they refashioned the office. It did break down the mostly break down the siloing of an office. Even the manager had to sit in an open plan. He was kind of, and it was a he, by the way, in those days, and that's an issue we can talk about later. He was off in a corner, but it was still nominally part of the open plan. The office was also structured based on an analysis that the architects and planners had done of movement and communication patterns within the office. So they really tried to mimic in the physical arrangement of the office the workflow of the people in it, rather than force people into a particular kind of pigeonholing.
And it absolutely took off from there, right? As of 2020, what did you find? Two-thirds of knowledge workers in the US are in open office workspaces?
Yeah, and that's a study by Gensler, which is the world's largest planning and architecture firm. And they, of course, design a lot of these offices. And that's the claim they make. And they have a research wing that does these kinds of analyses.
Even though we've hated them for 50 something years.
Yeah, this is one of those weird dynamics in life. And it also speaks to some of the other motivations beside communication patterns within an office for their persistence. So open offices typically let companies push more people into smaller spaces, less square footage per person, and that obviously will help with the real estate bills. So there's an economic financial drive, at least an explicit economic financial drive, to stuff people into an open office that I personally experienced. I went from an individual office in my first couple of jobs to an open plan, and then the open plan was progressively corkscrewed down, where more and more people were pushed into the same amount of space. Of course, there are costs to that in terms of employee productivity, turnover of staff, the just degradation of the work environment. But that doesn't maybe show up explicitly on a corporate, balance sheet, for example. I don't know how, I'm not an accountant, so I can't tell you exactly how that shows up or not. But the direct costs of real estate have to be weighed against these indirect costs, and that kind of balance is seldom really struck.
You can see how this sort of thing would disappear as managers are trying to weigh the pros and cons. No one who's quitting a job for another job is going to say, and on, and another thing, I really couldn't stand the open office. It probably doesn't even get mentioned by people.
Yeah, I mean, we're complicated beings in work as any other part of our lives, and we will stick with the job or leave it or move on or not move on or whatever decisions we make in our employment based on any number of factors. Obviously, salary, job satisfaction broadly, the people we work with, that's probably, I would say, the most important factor. And then in that will be the office. So it's kind of hard, you can't really tease it out as an independent variable in terms of your decisions. So it tends to get lost. It tends to get lost, but it's absolutely there. It's contributed to my, in those jobs where I had an open office, my lack of job satisfaction. And I think, going back to something you had said earlier, really the pandemic lockdown and the kind of work from home habit that developed really is essentially a dissatisfaction with the open office that people were able to kind of parse out from the other factors in their job and say, well, frankly, I really do want to work from home, or in a typically a hybrid setting. So prior to the pandemic, I had kind of a hybrid arrangement where I was going in the office 2 days a week, working from home three, and I found that to be ideal. I was always happy to go to the other place. It was always a variety, either to be working silently or independently at home where I could really concentrate, or more convivially, have the social interactions of an office. So I think a lot of people are trying to strike that particular balance today.
So I had a manager for years, very good manager, cared a lot about collaboration, and although it never happened to his satisfaction, his dream was to like blow out all the walls in the building. How do open plan offices, according to research, actually interfere with collaboration in some cases?
Yeah, this is, I think, probably the single most surprising development in the environmental psychology literature and just in people's direct reports of working in an open office. Because, a priori, back in, as I said, the late 60s, early 70s, people could say, well, I'm giving up this, I'm getting that. But it turns out they're giving up something and not really getting anything in return. The open plan, facilitates communication to a degree, but it also detracts from it. So I've been in offices, and I'm sure we all have, where people are just kind of lined up facing their computers with their headphones on, their noise canceling headphones on, trying to concentrate. You dare not disturb them. So that cuts off communications you might have with them. You can't really even turn to the person next to you and strike up a conversation or ask them a simple question because you fear you'll distract other people. You certainly don't want to broach any kind of private conversation, any kind of, it doesn't even have to be an issue that shouldn't be made public, because you just don't want to bother people with something that is between you and another person, let's say. And so often these open offices are just this kind of dead silent. You hear the air handling system in the background. You don't hear what the designers and the managers always speak of this hubbub of creative energies and sparks are flying and ideas are rolling. You just don't get that. Whereas when I had private office, typically what would happen is after sitting there for an hour and a half, you get bored, you get up, walk around, go to the printer, or whatever, and you make the excuse of seeing a colleague in another office. You knock on the door if they're not busy, or even if they are busy, you make a lunch or a coffee or a tea or whatever appointment with them. And then you would actually begin to strike up those serendipitous conversations that the managers really seem to value, and they seem to see as the positive benefit of an office. So ironically, the private offices, in my own personal experience, facilitate that more than an open office.
On the flip side of that, of course, plenty of people find these spaces incredibly distracting. Around here, because people are working with audio, often they'll put their headphones on, and sometimes it's because they're actively listening to something or editing, and other times it's just a signal like, please, I'm busy, do not bother me.
Exactly. So there you have a bunch of people, we're alone together kind of situation, where people are nominally next to each other, nominally able to communicate, but don't, because their requirements of their job are to really focus on, in your case, audio. I mean, I do a lot of interviews in my job. And when I had a private office, I would close the door and do my interview, open the door when I'm done. So that is very hard to do in an open plan. Some open plans, the good ones, have breakout rooms where you can kind of take your laptop or your recorder or whatever, go off to a little room. That's better than nothing, I guess, but it's also hard because sometimes I just need to reach around to a book that's behind me, or open a file, or have my papers laid out, and to have to port that off to a breakout room disrupts that train of thought.
Yeah, and there's no way we're not overhearing our colleagues, say, phone conversations. When I started my first job as a reporter, I remember feeling a little intimidated, like, what if the more experienced reporters heard me on the phone and thought I was saying something dumb? It might have been helpful to not have to worry about that.
Yeah. I mean, I've had exactly that same experience. You don't want other people making professional judgments of the conversation that you have, even if they're not kind of confidential conversations. And conversely, I would hear people yelling, halfway across the room, and I'd be like, well, like, really, that's how you talk to the people you're working with? I mean, you can't help but make these judgments, and just, they shouldn't, maybe there's a role for critiquing each other in an office, but I don't think this is the way that critique should be managed, by just catching snippets of a conversation.
George, another concern that some people may have that didn't come up here is just that they're being visually observed. We'll talk about their personal presentation, but it's also like people pass by and see what's on your computer screen. Even if you're doing your work, that can feel weird.
In addition to the noise issues, conversation, shuffling of papers issue, there's also just a visual environment of an open office is really, I think, inimical to concentrated, focused work. So you're seeing other people are then trying to hide what they're doing. There's all these buttons, like I don't use them myself, but I'm told there are buttons you can press that if you're playing a game and then someone walks by, you can press the button and shows a spreadsheet instead. So yeah, there's this kind of weird management of the presentation of your workspace to the outside world. And we are all of us are very different in how we curate, manage, personalize our workspaces. I'm someone who likes to put up pictures. I like to put up little tchotchkes, and that's part of personalizing and making my space comfortable for me. Other people go even further and put plants or lots of artwork around them, or go to a more minimalist extreme. And then that's also factoring into what we see of each other in the office. And at the end of the day, you're leaving the office to go home, and you want to leave your papers on. Maybe you're in the middle of something. You just want to leave them out and not have A, judgment, or B, worse, someone trying to clean up your papers for you. In some of these offices, there's no fixed workstations. People are recycling through workstations every day. It's got like a hot desking or hoteling arrangement. And then you can't leave your papers on your desk. You have to tidy them up. And that, I think for most professional workers, that's really hard, because you don't come to a neat end of an assignment at the 5 o'clock whistle or the equivalent thereof. You need to pick it up the next day. And then this clean desk policy really interferes with that thought process.
Yeah, that gives me anxiety just thinking about it. And I'm not messy so much in my office, but I know the moment I sit down, I don't have to think about where my pen is. I don't have to take it out of a briefcase. It's just ready to go. It seems like there's probably time wasted in having to reset yourself up every morning and then pack everything away every afternoon.
I completely agree. I have, I mean, we all have our own very particular work habits. I like my pen in a certain place, my paper in a certain place. So having to reconstruct that every morning is not just a time sink, but a kind of a psychic drain.
So the lack of privacy may create interesting kinds of pressure for some workers. Talk about what the research found that women in particular feel about being in some ways on display in an open design office.
Yeah, so I think one of the broad trends in the environmental psychology literature is really attending to differences of all sorts, and certainly gender differences. So women will report, and there's been a case of intensive case studies of this involving researchers not just conducting surveys, but actually going to work in that office themselves and taking in the office culture and observing, and actually observing their own response in some cases. And in an open office, women, especially men to some degree as well, but I think it presents differently, become very conscious of their appearance and might respond by wearing nicer clothing or lipstick or whatever, would try to up their appearance. And would a lot of people find that oppressive. They don't like being on display to begin with, and they certainly don't like having to conform to some kind of standard that's being applied to them. Now, this is an interesting and delicate topic, because people are highly varied. Some people like dressing up. That's just part of what the office means to them. Some people dress up in order to signal status within a hierarchy. Conversely, some people are willing to put up with that trade-off in order to gain maybe the conviviality of an open office. But broadly speaking, there does seem to be, and the literature shows this, a division between men's and women's response, just to take this as a binary situation for the time being, to the presentation in an open office.
And what's so interesting about this is that this phenomenon occurs whether or not people are like interfacing with clients, in which case it's maybe important to look your best every day.
Yeah, this isn't just a case of a lawyer getting ready to go into a court or into a meeting or whatever. This is just ordinary sitting at your desk, typing things in kind of situation.
Going back to intuitions about these things and how they can be wrong if we don't scientifically test them, it looks like open office plans are very democratic. What have researchers learned about how they might actually reinforce hierarchies within companies?
Yeah, I think this is a really important point, because one of the original motivations and one of the often stated motivations for an open office is a democratizing feature. So Mike Bloomberg famously sat in a bullpen when he was mayor of New York, surrounded by his employees. And wasn't that laudable, that even a billionaire mayor of New York could sit among his administrative assistants and other people? So there is a quality, ideally, to an open office. Although, in my experience, what often happens is the very people making the decision about the office environment have arrogated to themselves a private window and a corner office and so forth. So these ideals often, maybe more often than not, don't really transpire in reality. But in principle, the idea of an open office was to flatten the corporate hierarchy, or at least maybe not flatten the hierarchy itself. You still have a hierarchy, but to eliminate the physical obstacles within the hierarchy, for good and for bad. Sometimes it was because managers want to keep an eye on everybody and they don't trust people. Mm. And if you're not working, on the other times they just wanted themselves to be available. And I just think that in practice, open offices don't do that. In practice, open offices, my own experience and that of that comes out in a lot of these studies as well, is that they reinforce a corporate hierarchy. I gave the example earlier of fashion expectations in an office that fall mainly on women, to some extent on men too, but mainly on women. And they absolutely are shown to reinforce a hierarchy. People will dress in gradations of fashion to signal their status.
A colleague of mine has pointed out that the people making these decisions for the rest of us in the office are very often people who themselves have a fully enclosed workspace, a real office.
Isn't this the great irony of this whole thing? Again, it's not always the case. This is a subject on which it's hard to make any, definitive statements. But yes, I'm just very struck by how the people who rah, 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 open office and rah, 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 collaboration and communication are off there sitting in an office, and they say, well, I need a private office because I'm doing private confidential matters and or whatever, or maybe I'm just a bigwig and I don't care about you. But yeah, there's a high hypocrisy in this, absolutely.
George, what do we know about open office designs and the spread of infectious diseases?
So there has been some studies in this, and obviously COVID was a demonstration, or at least it reminded everybody that open offices do facilitate the spread of disease. And this is just seen in, usually in self-reported sick days or higher, systematically higher in an open office. One study that really struck me was done in Finland back in the mid-90s and showed that being in an open office was equivalent in the extra risk you had of catching a cold to being a parent of a young child. Huh. And anyone who's been a parent of a young child knows that they're bringing home colds all the time. You're all sniffling and sneezing. And it's likewise, an open office does the same to its workers.
So did the pandemic help get concerns about open offices taken more seriously? Are more companies rethinking this stuff?
Yeah, I think the pandemic did bring a spotlight to these office concerns, partly, and there's a number of reasons for that. One is there's just a cycle in thinking about open offices that we've seen since the 70s, that there's a back and forth in how people feel about offices, and there's a periodic attempt to spruce them up or address some of these concerns. In the 80s, that manifested as the introduction of cubicles, which were an attempt to make things a bit more private. And then the cubicles were later torn down because everyone hated them. So we went back to it. So it's been this back and forth cycle. And the pandemic kind of fell into that cycle, or the timing of the pandemic fell into that cycle as well. Then the pandemic directly introduced health concerns about open offices and made people very conscious of that. But I think most important of all, the pandemic just made a natural experiment, in a sense, of working from home. Working from home has been tolerated, sometimes put forward as a laudable, the mobile worker of the 90s and the early 2000s, the tech worker can work anywhere but the laptop. That was meant to be kind of a laudable model, but managers tended to look a little askance on it. They weren't sure if people were at home really just kicking back and watching TV or just having fun rather than doing their work. So there was kind of this distrust between management and workers. And then when everyone who had an office, not everyone was entitled or privileged enough to be able to decide to work from home. So we're focusing on those people who did have that privilege. Those people demonstrated, hey, I can actually work better. I actually work longer hours, more effectively from home. There's downsides. Nobody really likes to be on Zoom all day, but there's upsides in sense of ability to concentrate or dictate one's own timing. And if you have to pick up the kids or do whatever, you can go off and do that for an hour and then come back. So I think it was an overall kind of a voting with their feet kind of arrangement. People said, I really do want an individualized workspace. Not getting one at work, I'll take the home environment.
On the other side of that, most people who have worked in an open office space are aware that there's a certain amount of performing of work, right? Like people remain in their desks until the boss leaves, and there's a lot of, you know, maybe you can actually get your job done in 7 hours today. Maybe it takes 9 hours tomorrow. But if you're in an open office, you don't feel that flexibility to kind of work on your own schedule.
Yeah, so yeah, in addition to the physical environment of the home versus, or the home office versus the open plan or other kind of office formal arrangement, is the work flexibility that one has. Now there's also performing or performance that happens in working from home. People having Zoom open but not really being tuned in, or immediately responding to every Slack message they get. So even if that distracts from other work they're supposed to be doing. So we're humans. We're complicated. I think by and large, people just want to do their jobs well, and be recognized as such. But there's a performance that goes on to varying degrees in varying professions and varying office cultures. That certainly was in the open plan office, and I think to some extent still exists in work from home.
Why do you think so many companies establishing offices go straight to open office plans when they're creating these spaces? Are these just cheaper and maybe easier to change or accommodate new hires or new work teams?
So companies default to an open office for a variety of reasons. First of all, it has become the default option. Just numerically, that's what they see. That's, you know, monkey see, monkey do. So there's the culture, the norms that have been established around office design, just as they're, by the way, around home design. People are knocking down the wall between their kitchen and their dining room whenever they do a renovation. That's kind of the default. They see it, their friends do it, they do it too. Even though arguably you want to have separation of your kitchen from your dining room. Then there's the economics of the office, and that comes out in a couple different ways. So when offices, I'm generalizing, but when someone moves or a company moves into a new office space and they want private offices, that's usually on the landlord. So landlord will build the suit. They, you know, we want X number of offices, breakout rooms, copy room, whatever, kitchen. And the landlord will bring in workers, put up the partitions, make, you know, drywall that out. But when the company moves in to an open space with minimal partition walls, it's on the company to do that. So it changes the business or the financial model of how these offices are arranged. So now the company's buying furniture, which is on their operating budget rather than on their kind of the initial cost of moving into that new space budget. I'm not an expert on office budgeting. This is what the architects and the planners and managers I've been looking to tell me. There's definitely an economic model that's been built up around open plan offices that, and the furniture companies love that, of course. I mean, now they're selling partitions that they wouldn't be selling if people were having drywall around their offices.
These offices are broadly unpopular with almost anybody working in them, George. What did you learn about why they can be especially hard on workers with certain disabilities or with neurodivergent brains?
So this is really a very important development of the past years, and it comes out of a longer trend of recognizing difference in general in our society, but difference in workers and their needs for an office. So everybody has unique requirements and idiosyncrasies in an office. And there are people who have tolerances for office environments. So people who are neurodivergent, which might include ADHD, autism, and so forth, may be more sensitive to the visual environment of the office. Maybe they're more easily distracted because of the way their brains process information. People who are deaf, people who are hard of hearing, struggle in an open office for a variety of reasons. If they're using cochlear implants or hearing aids, they'll struggle because the noise environment is kind of hard to control. So noise tends to carry, and it's hard to really filter that out with an artificial device. People who are signing will struggle because the visual cacophony of an office makes it difficult to perceive signs, and even more importantly, the facial expressions that go along with the signs and indicate the kind of that modulate the meaning of the sign. And I think the deaf, capital D deaf community has a strong ethos about inclusivity and about making sure that everyone is included in a conversation that you see really at Gallaudet, you see in deaf schools, and just whenever deaf people gather, that they physically rearrange their setting in order to make sure sight lines, backgrounds are conducive to communication. And these needs are shared by everybody, but I think certain communities of people are more attuned to them. So I'm neither deaf nor do identify as neurodivergent, but I'm affected in the same way that deaf and neurodivergent people are by these same things, but maybe I just brush it off or I ascribe it to myself. I internalize the critique and I say, well, I should be able to buckle down and ignore that distraction. Whereas I think people in these communities, and this is really a principle of the disabilities rights movement, are more likely to speak up. And in speaking up about the design deficiencies and difficulty of communication and difficulty of concentration of an office will help everybody.
I want to talk, George, about the kinds of designs that might actually produce the effects managers have hoped for from open offices. First, as you pointed out before the break, we need to recognize one plan does not fit all workers. We've seen now the rise of flex office designs. What does that term mean?
So the term flex office or non-territorial office encompasses a broad range of office paradigms. So the term flex office or non-territorial office encompasses a multitude of designs. There's hoteling where you can kind of, and all of them have the common aspect that you don't have a fixed office. So in some cases, you can reserve a desk hoteling or reserve even a private office. Or in some cases, you don't get anything. You come in that day, you still put your stuff in a locker and scramble for an office. And some people like it. I don't. But I can see the appeal to some people. It gives them flexibility. It's sort of like mimicking a situation in a coffee shop where you can choose whatever table you want. It could allow some flexibility of, well, today I don't really feel like talking to people, or rather my work requires me to concentrate and not engage in meetings and so forth. So I'll sit off in the corner if indeed there is a separate corner to sit in. That's important. Another day, I really have to meet with, you know, these three people. And so I'll sit at the communal table to do that. So it gives people flexibility. And that's flexibility and that kind of communication, collaboration, facilitating is really kind of the rationale for these non-territorial or flex offices. But on the other hand, I mean, you're giving up a lot to gain that flexibility. Any ability to personalize your space, it's really gone. You lose the ability just to leave your stuff out overnight and not have to tidy up your office and thereby disrupt your entire thought process. I'm one of these people. I kind of personally have a middle attitude toward clutter. I basically keep a neat desk, but I do have piles around that represent projects I'm working on. And that's important because when I come back to my desk, I can pick up the top paper in the pile and resume what I was doing. Can't really do that with a non-territorial or flex type of arrangement. And people who are really messy, who really require lots of mess on their desk as kind of a reflection of what's going on in their heads, they're really out to sea on this. So to me, this kind of bifurcation or dichotomy of views on flex offices is indicative of a larger issue, which is one size does not fit all. So one size does not fit all in terms of working habits and practices. One size does not fit all in terms of gendering of offices. Certainly in a binary sense, but you know, now we're in a multivariate sense in our gender concepts. So that's definitely not incorporated into the office. It's not there in terms of the issues of neurodivergence and people who are deaf and have both sensory and, more importantly, arguably cultural norms around how an office should be structured. So I think the emerging view of this is, first, there needs to be a diversity of working arrangements and possibilities. People can work from home, can work from home. People work in an office should have multiple environments within the office to work from. And second, there needs to be employee involvement in the design of an office. This is such a crucial issue, and it's really I think the disabilities rights movement has really been at the forefront of nothing without us, nothing about us without us. That can inform office design more generally. The employees should be involved in the design of their offices. In my experience, that just does not happen.
You know, just to go back for a minute to what you said about non-territorial workspaces, I can understand, especially if someone only needs to be in once a week or so, why this might work. Companies can get by with fewer workspaces than they might otherwise. On the other hand, it occurs to me there's probably always that one space that everybody covets for whatever reason, like it's closer to a window or away from the hallway, whatever. Suddenly you've got people kind of competing for this prized space. And boy, starting off the day mad that you didn't get to work where you wanted to, it can kind of dampen, you know, your mood the rest of the day.
And there's two issues there, really. One is just the kind of toll it takes of having to scramble for space. And often what happens is people default. They kind of park themselves, and it's kind of culturally or, you know, socially acknowledged within the office that this is George's space, this is Chris's space, et cetera. And even though it's not formally set up, we kind of make these accommodations like probably we did back in grade school where, you know, your friends would and you would sit at one table, even though it wasn't designated your table, you would go there. Then what was the rest of your question?
Just this idea that everybody wants the same space and there's only one to go around of the most prized desk that there is.
Right. So there's definitely a kind of a toll in allocating or setting yourself up within an office that doesn't have fixed stations or offices for people. But on the other hand, the way you frame the question is important because with the hybrid working arrangement, people are not coming to the office every day. So companies are, you know, legitimately probably entitled to say, you know, we can't really reserve an office for George every day because he's not here. You know, that's just a huge, we'd have to multiply the amount of space that we need for that. Or people who really work out of the office or on sales trips or whatever, marketing people, et cetera, or people who travel a lot. See, there's a good rationale then for a non-territorial or flex arrangement to handle those kinds of situations. So probably given the patterns of work we've seen for at least knowledge workers since the lockdown, people really, most companies are moving to basically a hybrid arrangement. I think probably we'll be seeing a non-territorial model for some time to come, and we'll have to get our personalization in our home offices.
For companies that are dead set on open offices, are there ways they can make the design of the rest of the office work in concert with this? Like, what kinds of other meeting spaces and alternative workspaces might actually make this work?
So I think this is really the emerging, you're really touching on the emerging kind of thinking on this. Probably the open office is here to stay. So most of us will work in open offices. Some will have private offices, but broadly speaking, we're in open offices. So the question is, how do we make those better? So one is, as you say, to provide lots and lots and lots of flexibility. That would include flexibility where to sit within the office, the flexibility of what breakout room to go to, what little breakout room to have a phone conversation in, what slightly larger breakout room to have a one-on-one or one-on-few meeting in. We used to have at the Scientific American, when I first started there, a beautiful library that was filled with reference books and so forth. And maybe that's a slightly older model, but I think we could have equivalents of that in an office as well, some kind of resource room. But I think there's the other issue is and this is harder to articulate. It's really something we bring in the designers and the architects for. There are small but telling tweaks that can be made to an office that also facilitate diversity. And this is where I think the inclusive design principles developed, certainly for the deaf community, Gallaudet, the deaf space concept, and also some of the designs we're seeing for neurodivergent people, people with autism, ADHD, and so forth. They make what is to the perhaps untrained eye small changes, but they're ones that once they're made are just like, whoa, how could I live without it? So one thing that was done in the offices at Gallaudet University was to use a lot of translucent glass so that deaf people would be generally aware of the presence of other people, which is extremely important, both just personally and culturally, but would also be insulated from them, would have a degree of a privacy and a degree of the ability to just focus on things. So those are the kinds of measures that can't really be reduced to a slogan, but once the designers come in and with their expertise view a space can, and also talk to the people who use that space, can begin to implement these changes. One that, having just said we don't have any broad principles, but one principle that does seem to come out is lighting. Lighting is huge, huge, and usually neglected. The need for natural lighting, the need for lighting that doesn't glare. So there's an attention to lighting that really you need a lighting specialist, a lighting designer to handle, because most of us just don't have that kind of awareness or expertise. So anyway, the two principles here then would be ample breakout rooms of various forms and an expert design to come in to tweak, to put in measures that wouldn't occur to most people.
It comes up in your piece, George, to this question of involving workers in the office design process in a meaningful way. Workers say, oh yeah, we were consulted on this design, but it was basically to get buy-in. Like, what does it take to actually gather input and act on that in a way that feels to workers like they've been listened to?
Yeah, I mean, it's a laborious process getting feedback. I mean, you put three people in a room, you get 10 ideas, right? So there's the designers have to really have a systematic way to gather that in a meaningful way. So there'll be focus groups, small groups, which have their dynamics. So sometimes, but you have to have a variety of techniques. Surveys are the kind of method of choice, but they have their limits as well. Because if I say I'm bothered by noise on a scale of 1 to 10 at 3, what does that really even mean? I mean, it's specific to that person. So I think talking to people, some of these environmental psychology studies that are really deep ones are the psychologist goes and goes to the office and just works there as an employee, as effectively an employee, and just talks to people informally and eventually gets a sense of what's right and what's wrong in that office environment. So the inclusivity, just to speak to that a moment, I once moved from a company I worked for, I went from a private office to an open plan. And they did nominally, notionally, the kind of process I've outlined. They gave us surveys, someone came and talked to us. They, you know, I detailed how I had to walk out of my office and go down the hall to get to the printer, you know, whatever. They kind of mapped out the workflow of people in the office, and they said, oh, we're going to make it so much more efficient. So they're conducting the survey, but in the meantime, one of my colleagues says, hey, George, let's actually go to that office we're moving to and take a look. And I was a little bit like, I don't know if I want to do that politically within the office, but he dragged me along and we went in and we actually saw the space. We kind of basically snuck into it. And we saw that space had already been built out. On one side, they were asking our opinion, promising to take our opinion into account. On the other, they had already built the space. There was no further customization to be done. So I think this is so typical of every person I've ever met who's ever been through an office redesign, is basically the managers, upper managers, not even the people you work with managers, but the people who don't work in that office managers, just make a decision. We're just going to build the office this way, and, you know, we're just going to throw away those surveys. The surveys will just be put into the trash can. And that's kind of what happens. And I think it's taking the disabilities rights movement to come along and say, hey, we're not putting up with that. We're just not. You are going to have to include us in this office design or we're leaving. We're walking. So that's had an effect and will continue to have an effect.
Any sense of what the typical American office will look like in 10 years?
First of all, anyone who's honest about this, and I'll start off with the honest answer, is like, I have no idea, right? But having said that, I think we can see glimpses of new ideas. A lot of these inclusive design principles can be incorporated that have been developed in deaf schools, for example, and can be brought in. And so some of those features, I think, will be incorporated. But one huge trend I think we're seeing is, because so few people are going to the office, or rather they're on a hybrid arrangement, companies are left with a lot of space. Landlords are left with a lot of space, and they're going to be doing or trying to do residential conversions. And that also hits the other side of this equation, which is, you know, rents are so ridiculously high in most of the big cities, and we need more living space for people. A lot of offices, buildings really weren't built for that. They're just the layout of the floor doesn't arrange it. So I've heard some creative ideas about basically crenellating the exterior, making the curtain wall jagged almost like a wall of a castle, so that there's more windows per square foot than before. And then you can have someone's living room up against that, and then maybe deeper into the core of the building, you would put other kinds of utility spaces. So I think you're going to see office conversions. And if that does happen, I think those new offices and new residential and co-working spaces can be built to these inclusive design principles of openness and attending to the visual and the sonic cacophony.
George Musser is a contributing editor at Scientific American, where you can read his article, Fixing the Hated Open Design Office. George, this has been so interesting. Thanks for the conversation.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me and letting me rant about these offices and discuss some of the new ideas for improving them.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. And if you want the podcast, it's available free wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think and then subscribe. You can also listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.